You've entered Bookstorm with Kristen Civiletto and me, Chris Storm. This is a podcast devoted to best-selling books that matter, books that make a difference. We're diving down deep with beloved authors about their stories. We're exposing hot-button topics and heartfelt themes, the issues that affect each of us in our own lives, as siblings, parents, partners, friends, as human beings. We're braving new ideas, fresh thoughts, hard lessons, and important truths. Those kinds of things that stay with us long after we turn the last page and close the book. Welcome back to Bookstorm Podcast, book lovers. Strap on your seatbelts for this one. We've got a thriller that's coming out January 2nd that Kristen and I predict is going to be huge. We have the author from London with us here today. Welcome, Matthew Blake.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me.
We're here to talk about your debut novel, Anna O, for our YouTube watchers. And before we do, let me tell our listeners a little bit about you. So before writing fiction, Matthew worked as a researcher and a speechwriter at the Palace of Westminster. Wow. He studied English at Durham University and Merton College in Oxford. And now he lives in London. And here's how we got started with this book. After discovering that the average person spends, wait to hear this, 33 years of their life asleep, that was a shocker, Matthew felt the pull of a story. He began extensive research into sleep-related crimes and into a mysterious illness known as resignation syndrome, which I never heard of until I opened this book, but it's fascinating. And it sparked a thrilling question. If someone commits murder while sleepwalking, are they innocent or guilty? And the novel Anna O was born. Now I'm going to quote a couple of endorsements. David Baldacci and Nita Prose, who have been on Bookstorm podcast, we consider them good friends of Bookstorm. David says, "The twist is one of the best I've ever read." Nita says, "This book will keep you turning pages well after your bedtime. It's being called across the globe the thriller that will wake up the nation, and we love it." Thanks for joining us, Matthew.
No, well, thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for all those nice words.
Matthew, we give our listeners just a little bit of the backdrop of the book, and it's kind of hard here for me because we are not giving away any spoilers. That's kind of hard to do in this one. So just very briefly, in your story, Anna O has not opened her eyes for 4 years. Yes. She was found in a very deep sleep in a very dark forest near the bodies of her friends and fellow journalists. Yes. Now, she is the prime suspect, of course, in their double murder. And Dr. Benedict Prince, he goes by Ben, is a London psychologist and a sleep expert. And he has been assigned the task of waking her up. Now, she suffers, as Chris mentioned, from resignation syndrome. And this is when a patient enters a very deep sleep. It could last for years. And it's a way of directly avoiding trauma that may have occurred to them or something they witnessed. And Ben, or Dr. Prince, he had previously proposed a treatment for this kind of a syndrome just in an article that he had written. But now the government wants him to experiment on Anna, and who the press calls Sleeping Beauty, which I thought was interesting, and try out this method. The authorities need to figure out whether she is guilty or she is innocent. Now, before she went to sleep, and again, no spoilers, she was working to uncover a potential connection between a notorious killer and a secret government experiment called Medea. Now, Anna may or may not be a killer, but there is something even more nefarious afoot. Here, Dr. Prince, or Ben, explores this complicated psychology of sleep and guilt, and then his own life is thrown into turmoil. Now, would you like to add anything as far as the factual background to that, or do you want to leave it there?
Well, no, I mean, one of the big things when I was writing the book was to ensure that everything was based on real life. And it's, I mean, all my favorite thrillers and mysteries, I think, are all based totally on fact, really. And so, yeah, everything in there, there's lots of Easter eggs and sort of rabbit holes for people to go down. Early readers have already said they, once they get on Google and start looking up all these things, they can't stop. And so, yeah, it's full of all that. And I hope readers will have a cheeky Google and a Wikipedia and see that all this stuff is really scary and really real.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Chris and I each research different things, and including the connections with Freud, you know, talking about this, the birth of psychology as a discipline. You are exactly right. This book fascinates on many levels.
It was.
Well, thank you.
It enthralling. I just couldn't get over it. And I want to say for our listeners about this resignation syndrome. So they're calling it a functional neurological disorder, a non-organic disease of the brain. But let's put it in layman's terms. Adults and children fall asleep for months or years in order to escape life. Wow. It can't be fully explained or cured. The illness is psychological and physical, so the treatment has to be too. And I love this. So Ben starts treating Anna with things like Chanel perfume, violet flowers, music from her childhood. We see touch, sound, smell, and speech. We use these in hospice at the end of life. We use these for patients during comas. I had to ask you as the writer, with your research, can you expand upon this theory? Why is it so important in your story? And why is this method so really successful?
Well, I mean, that's one of the fascinating things. So I'm fascinated by these mystery illnesses, as they call them, the functional neurological diseases, what might have been called decades ago, you know, psychosomatic, and the way in which the mind and the body always are talking to each other and relate to each other. And particularly the theory which is put forward by someone like Suzanne O'Sullivan, who's a very eminent neurologist, about the reason that resignation syndrome occurs is the absence of hope. So one of the most famous examples is refugee children in Sweden who are applying for asylum, and when their asylum application is denied, tend to fall into a deep sleep from which they can't be woken. And it seems to be that without any hope in life, that your body does shut down, that you can go to sleep in really. And I'm, as a someone who's studied myth and literature, and that idea of a deep sleep is a very mythic ancient idea. And so I was just absolutely fascinated seeing it as a medical reality, as something that people are encountering and trying to explain. And I think all the people who are working on this at the moment are looking at how you restore hope to people's lives. And that is through sensations, that is through noise, that is through things related to your early childhood that might have given you enjoyment or excitement. And all those things are needed to restore a sense of hope in your life and for your mind to recognize there's a future and your body to then react.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really was fascinating. And, you know, this is the other reason why I think this book is going to be so big, is that it, even though this is a mystery and a thriller, it's personal to the reader, because we all sleep. Exactly. We all dream. We all can't figure out why we can't sleep. We all spend a ton of money on mattresses and bedrooms and light blocking shades. And my kids listen to this white noise. It drives me crazy. And so, yes, we can all relate to it. We're like, yeah, we all have sleep issues at some point in our life. This takes it like to the 1,000th degree, which is pretty cool.
Yes. Well, that was definitely, I mean, I sort of, you know, pitched my editors that there's a potential readership of 8 billion people because we all sleep. And, you know, I was looking for that universal experience. What I think the great thrillers take that universal experience and then go somewhere interesting with it. And I thought, you know, sleep is the sort of second life we all live. It's the one universal experience across continents and cultures. And and then when you get into the research and see all the terrifying things we actually can do when we sleep, in terms of sleepwalking, the ideas of our eyes being open, but our brains being asleep, The idea of the unconscious, which we still don't really understand. Gosh, it's even more terrifying when you get into it than I ever imagined. And I, yeah, now I know all of it. I'm not sure I'm my sleeping patterns aren't as good as they used to be. Let's put it like that.
I want to pick up on something you were just talking about or alluding to, and that is this difference between the mind and the brain. Yeah. Okay. Now, Ben had some really interesting insights, and I just want to read one particular quote because this one just stopped me in my tracks. This is a quote from Ben, Dr. Prince. Fear starts in the head and affects the body. So many disorders of the mind can be traced back to the primordial forest. It is why it is such a unique symbol in fairy tales and myths. Leaving home and entering the forest is a metaphor for shedding the comforts and traumas of childhood and entering the wilderness of adulthood. Without the right tools or preparation, crossing that threshold results in a psychic fracture and disintegration. Now, that stopped me in my tracks for a number of reasons, and I want to ask you about one of them. If we start to understand that concept of tools and preparation, shouldn't that revolutionize the way that we raise children, educate them, or deal with juvenile delinquents? What do you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that mind-brain distinction, I think, is an absolutely fascinating one. I mean, I think we know a bit more about the brain now and all the research that's gone on into that. But the mind is still such a, is it an art? Is it a science? It's such a sort of nebulous concept. And I don't think anyone's ever quite probe the mysteries of the mind. And I'm very interested in myth and the great series with Joseph Campbell about the power of myth and the way in which all those steps in human life as you mature and your brain matures are seen through the stages of myth, and how really, although we think sort of modern science has got all the answers, actually a lot of the tools for mental resilience are all there in stories. And if you think about what a story is, it's about people encountering obstacles and finding ways around them. It's about the hero overcoming difficulty. So I think story is a very interesting sort of mental roadmap in terms of how to navigate life. And I think that's why we're all drawn to particularly thrillers. I think Lee Child wrote a very interesting book called The Hero about this, and it's about why has this story form endured? Why do we keep reading mysteries and thrillers? And I think it's because it gives us tools for how to overcome the obstacles we find in life. And while we won't be encountering the obstacles that thriller heroes find, we all encounter obstacles in our daily life, and getting that resilience and that strength and that sort of cunning to find a way around them is what all primal stories are really all about.
Yeah, I was thinking as I was reading that, and that was such a thoughtful thing you just said, but I was thinking about the fact that in today's day and age, there's a lot more stories and a lot more ideas about what types of tools might be appropriate and maybe less agreement.
That is true. That is very true. And I think, it was very interesting when you look at viewing data or reading data or things that come out, and the things that still attract a large audience and the things that we still instinctively gather around, we do like to see people overcome the obstacles. We like to see that archetypal narrative, and I think that is rooted deep in our minds and deep in our collective psychology. And I think we're only beginning to understand how powerful that is, and how the Greek myths or the ancient tales actually embody that sort of wisdom. That's why they've lasted. That's why we still read them today.
So excellent. True. In addition to that, the myths and in that old way of thinking also believed that dreams had meaning, and then maybe they foretold your future. So when we enter that sleep state, it's almost like we've entered another reality. That's I think what makes it so interesting. Let me ask you about this, because this was interesting to me. This paralogism, Aristotle spoke about it often. Ben explains it this way to Harriet. It's a false conclusion reached through faulty reasoning. If A happens before B, then A must have caused B. Well, it sounds convincing, but logically it's nonsense. In the real world, we want to believe that everything in life makes sense, that everything happens for a reason, that everything is explainable, but that is a twist of truth and it supports a faulty hypothesis. Why do we, and including in the mystery of this book, want to come up with the quickest, easiest conclusion and stay there?
Well, that is extremely interesting. I think that's something I grapple with as a lover of mysteries and a lover of puzzles and riddles and all those things, is I think we do have an instinctive desire to see patterns and to see logic and for things to make sense. And I think what probably terrifies all of us most of all is the idea of randomness, the idea of the fates, you know, that we, it's simply bad luck. We hate that idea. We want to have agency and the idea that our actions cause a reaction and we're in control of our own lives. And I think that, again, is another comfort that storytelling provides. I think that plot provides, that mysteries provide. I think that's, I mean, that's certainly what I love in mysteries. I love where you have that riddle and there is an answer and there is a solution to the problem, and that all the clues and all the planning and all those sort of wonderful twists, they all come together in a satisfying way and it all makes sense. And when I was planning Anna Rowe and trying to get a twist that would fool even the most sort of seasoned mystery reader who's watched every Netflix box set and read every book, and I was thinking, how on earth do I fool even them? And so all that planning, but it's that great satisfaction when it all lands and all those different bits come together, that sort of pattern making bit of our brains. So I think that's, going back to that Aristotle quote, I think that's why we fall into that trap, because we just like things making sense. And but sadly, the real world, it doesn't always make sense. But in mysteries, thankfully, it does.
And that's, I can't give spoilers, but the ending to this book was fantastic. Really great.
And Matthew, Chris is one of those people that you were just talking about. She will get 20 pages into a book, call me up and tell me that she's already figured it out. It drives me crazy. I did not get a call with your book. I'm going to just
Good. Very pleased.
In your story, somebody says to Ben, psychology is the one thing true crime rarely does well. Yeah. Everyone focuses on the who and the how rather than the why. Only drama, art, fiction, if you like, gets to the emotional truth of things. So I want to ask you, who do you think has better insights into the why? Are they scientists, artists, or people who embrace a little bit of all these disciplines? What do you think?
Well, I definitely think it's people who embrace all of those disciplines. I mean, I think that's what's so interesting about the idea of the mind, the idea of these mystery illnesses, and particularly the work of people who, Susanna Sullivan, again, is the name I go back to, because who have a real interest in, know the science, they're neurologists, they've done all the scientific side, but also recognize with these mystery illnesses, with these functional neurological disorders, there is an art side to them as well. You've got to understand the person and the background and the history and the circumstance. And it's not a matter of just sort of surgically fixing a few wires here and there. You've got to understand the person as a whole. And I think that goes right back to the start of psychology. I mean, you get that in Studies in Hysteria, which is the sort of most famous book, I guess, on mystery illness from Freud, and the original case study of Anna Rowe. And you have to understand the life of the person to understand what's gone wrong with them and what their symptoms are. So I think that intersection of art and science, I think that's where the most interesting things are happening. And that, for me as a novelist, is what I'm most interested in.
Yeah, that's excellent, because you think about how our world is increasingly specialized in some, you know, respects, especially in the medical field. Yeah. And I think we lose something. And right?
Yeah. And I think that's what, I mean, if you've ever gone and visited Freud's house in Hampstead, which I did while I was writing this book. Again, it's a fascinating thing. You go into his treatment room and you've got the famous Freudian couch, but around it, you've got all these artifacts from all around the world and Egyptian myths. And so, I mean, that is the sort of embodiment of the meeting of art and science and how one discipline can inform the other. And I think we lose a huge amount if we split those two things apart.
Yeah, well said.
It was phenomenal. I got to show another picture of the book for our YouTube watchers, Anna O by Matthew Blake. In the meantime, you're going to want to connect with him. You can find him on matthew-blake.com. He's got book clubs, extras, news, giveaways. He's on X, Instagram. And we have to ask you, is there a sequel? Are you working on another book?
Oh, I am working on another book. I'm knee deep in book two at the moment. So it's not a sequel, but it is in the same sort of realm. It's all about false memory. So it's what are the things we misremember? What are the terrible things we might have done that our minds have blanked out? It's exploring all of that. So and there's almost even more stuff to explore there than sleep. So I'm really, really enjoying it.
Oh, that sounds really captivating. We're going to love that one. Can't wait for it. Best of luck to you. We believe this book is going to be huge. We're going to be airing it on the Pub Day. And thanks for joining us here today, Matthew.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Chris, that was a deep, deep dive into things that we still don't even understand all that well. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that difference between the mind and, you know, the brain with a really quick quote. This was in the book. The mind has its own place and in itself can make a heaven of hell and a hell of heaven. This was written by Milton, the poet. And so I wanted to see what you thought about that because, you know, this was one of those books that you have more questions as you're reading and you can't stop thinking about it when you close the book.
It's compelling because we all sleep and we all dream. And so this mind-brain difference is really intriguing. You know, I feel like what you're saying is exactly what you discussed with him, the physical versus the emotional. And I sometimes believe we are the cause of a lot of our own problems. Like in that quote, you can allow your mind to start going down pathways where it shouldn't go. On the other hand, physically, you may have had brain damage. You may have a physiological issue with your brain that prevents you from thinking logically and calculating. I see this brain as being a whole mini universe that has not yet been fully discovered. Like our universe, like the ocean floor, we still don't know a lot about the brain. What do you think?
Yeah. And as you were pointing out, you know, sometimes these harms are trauma. There are emotional harms. They might be physical harms. They might be harms from toxins, from neurotoxins. And so trying to understand and sort out what is physical, what is emotional, you know, what is affecting the mind and the way and the patterns in which we think, we have no idea about this realm. And as somebody who's very familiar with, you know, brain injury and traumatic brain injury, I am realizing that we don't know a lot. But we are starting to understand that there are treatments, there are approaches like explored in this book that we hadn't considered before because we did not look at it holistically. And so that was one of the cool things in this story that comes across loud and clear is this idea of, you know, what is the role of hope?
I love that he added that to this story. When I got to that, I underlined it and I flipped dog-eared the page because isn't that kind of what we always say in life, that you'd got to have hope? If you have no hope, how do you continue to move on? And if your only future ahead is misery, no wonder these children in Stockholm fell asleep and wouldn't wake up again. And I think of this, like, you know, I know for patients in coma, all of these things are being used. They give music, they give a scent. Now, the catch is this. You can't return someone to a period in their life that was traumatic and not positive. So with all of these stimulants, they have to return them to a hopeful, peaceful, happy place. When my dad was dying and he was in hospice, I put his favorite music in my iPhone on his shoulder. I am telling you, his demeanor changed from worried, frustrated to total peace. Yeah. I just couldn't get over it. I thought, yes, these things matter to us. They're important. I kind of like how take away all science, all investigation, every medical field, and sometimes things come down to basic human needs. Yeah, love, absolutely. Hope, peace, faith in something. I kind of like that. Absolutely. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, and I have a weird example. My head will sometimes shut down a little bit because of an injury that I had. My kids have a playlist of certain songs that my brain instantly feels better. And I'm going to laugh. It's Justin Timberlake songs for some reason. And it's funny because that's not even what I normally listen to. I just like some of his songs. I'm much more of a country girl. But I will tell you, in those songs, whatever the beat is, the rhythm, there's something about it that my brain locks onto and I start feeling coming back to myself. So there's science that's starting to come online to support these theories. But as Matthew pointed out, as he's diving in, you know, we're at the beginning stages. Like you said, this is an unexplored frontier.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this, because this was intriguing. In the book, it said, dreams are our highways to our darkest secrets, possibly even our darkest memories. And the most popular dreams in the world, I'm going to list it. This is crazy, because I have some of these. And for all you listeners, teeth falling out. Don't have it. Raise your hand if you get it, if you have it, Kristen. Being chased by someone.
Oh.
Unable to find a toilet.
Nope.
Flying somewhere. I mean, bodily flying through the air.
Yep.
Being unprepared for an exam.
I'm going to give 5 for that.
Me too. And it's always my math class, because obviously I'm not a math. Falling with no safety net. Getting stuck in an out of control vehicle. Being late for something. Stumbling across an empty, unused room.
Wow.
Yeah, is that in? It said that we all share a lot of these.
Yes.
So yeah, this shows the mind versus brain. What we have locked in here, I believe, since our birth. Now, people say it doesn't matter to what a one-year-old sees or hears, they're not going to remember it. Maybe they don't remember it, but maybe it forms who they become.
Agreed. Agreed.
Any other ideas you wanted to bring up?
Just that I think the next book, I can't wait to see what he explores, because I'll tell you what, he is a deep thinker, but it's accessible. And the story is so gripping that it causes you to want to know more. So I can't wait to see what he's doing.
Idea. Memories that we've suppressed.
Yes.
We probably all have them. Or how about memories that we have retold, rewritten for our own well-being?
Yeah.
This is already, as soon as you brought that up, I thought, oh, I can't wait for that one. So we're very excited. We've got a full list coming up here. I don't have time to tell you the titles, but I'm going to tell you the authors because you'll remember their names. We have Jenny Colgan, Nick Petrie, Jill Shalvis, Mary Kubica, back for a second time, AJ Hatley, CJ Ray, Michelle Gable, Dervla McTiernan, Wabshag Rice, Susan Mallory, Lisa Unger, back for a second time, Heather Gudenkoff, back for a second time, Liza Palmer, Christopher Reich, and Abbott Collar.
That's awesome. And listeners, we now have, you know, you listeners in 73 countries or territories, all 50 states, and 1,500 plus cities. We are thankful. We are so excited that you're joining us and tuning in and diving deep with us. And we ask that you share our socials and that you stay with us. You can visit us on bookstormpodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook, on Instagram, on X, on TikTok. And if you go to YouTube, you can look at our videos and see our authors. And let me tell you, there's 100 plus of those episodes, both on the podcast and on YouTube. So listen in. We are very, very excited that you are joining us. Until next time, one of the best ways to brave the storm is to dive down deep into life-changing fiction.